The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slotkey from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2019 issue of Discover Magazine. We begin with the cover story, The Future of Fertility. At Discover, we focus on the scientific advances that will shape tomorrow's world. So it's only natural that we dive into the most fundamental way humans create the future, reproduction. Our society is in the middle of a potential watershed moment for what's been, until recent history, the most primal of processes. New technologies are making it increasingly possible to intervene in the creation of human life, whether this entails altering an embryo's DNA before it's born, or using genetic information to assess potential mates, we have the tools to mold future generations more explicitly than ever before. This power brings new responsibilities and ethical worries. We need to look not only to history and science fiction to see the potential pitfalls of gene editing, artificial gestation, and more. Still, these technologies could take humanity to new heights, both figuratively and literally. If we're to live in space, for example, we'll also need to reproduce there. Today's research advances could one day allow us to do so safely and ethically. This package of stories, part of a larger series, explores the groundbreaking work that is shaping the future of fertility. You can find the series online at www.discovermagazine.com/fertility. Repairing the Future. A research team in Oregon hopes gene editing technology will put an end to inherited diseases. Translucent sperm wriggled slowly across a sepia-toned laptop screen. Normally they're much faster, the embryologist tells me, but these little guys are slogging through a gooey liquid that slows them down. It makes them easier to catch. A skinny, hollow needle enters the scene from screen right and approaches a swimmer. The device sucks it inside, tail first. Its tiny, round body remains visible inside the clear sperm vacuum. The screen blinks to a new scene. The sperm disappear and are replaced by much larger, free-floating eggs, human eggs. Another instrument arrives on screen, nudging one of the eggs until it floats away like a gently bumped beach ball. After another try, the finger-like device successfully grabs an egg, using gentle suction to hold it in place. The producer of the show is researcher Nuria Marti Gutierrez, who sits at the microscope near the screen, never taking her eyes off her quarry as her hands maneuver between a half dozen knobs and dials. The process she's running is invisible to the naked eye. Each of these plays out in a clear droplet on the microscopic stage. Off-screen, the sperm vacuum makes a quick pit stop to grab an additional solution before appearing again, poised and ready. In a moment, the egg will be injected not only with sperm, but with a dose of CRISPR-Cas9, a DNA editing system that allows scientists to cut out a gene segment and replace it with another. If all goes well, the CRISPR system will cause the single-celled human embryo to repair a disease-causing mutation in its DNA. This lab at Oregon Health and Science University, or OSU, in Portland, is the only group in the U.S. to publish this kind of research in human embryos. The scientists are researching human gene editing in the hopes of curing specific inherited diseases. Since their claims in 2017 to have successfully repaired embryos that had a disease-causing mutation, they faced backlash from skeptical scientists and opponents of human gene editing. Now, after a Chinese researcher announced the birth of gene-edited twin girls in late 2018, they will have even more hurdles to clear before they can bring their technology to clinics. Perhaps no one was more surprised at the news that gene-edited babies had been born in China than the OSU team at the Center for Embryonic Cell and Gene Therapy, led by Shokrat Mitalipov. I thought I knew all of the legitimate groups working on this, Mitalipov. Chinese researcher He Jiankui's announcement last November came on the eve of the International Summit on Human Genome Editing in Hong Kong. He was scheduled to give a talk on his work shortly after Mitalipov's colleague Paula Amato, an associate professor of obstetrics and gynecology and a doctor in the OSU fertility clinic. I was quite shocked to hear that someone actually had the guts to transfer these embryos and establish a pregnancy, given the uncertainty regarding safety, says Amato. Metallopov estimates the gene editing technology won't be ready for clinical trials, meaning tests in real pregnancies, for another 5 to 10 years. Beyond the scientific challenges, the legal and ethical considerations normally keep this kind of research at a slower pace. In 2017, the National Academies of Science and Medicine brought together ethics experts and scientists to decide, in part, whether and how to allow changes to the human germline, changes to DNA that would be passed on to future generations. The report's criteria were to serve as international guidelines for human gene editing research. But his work fell well outside these parameters, triggering a huge backlash from scientific and ethics communities worldwide. For instance, the National Academy's report specifies that any editing of DNA should prevent a serious heritable disease. However, he started with a healthy gene and created a mutation thought to increase resistance to HIV. Another criterion is that the edit should happen only in the absence of reasonable alternatives. But HIV is considered preventable and treatable. The list goes on, with many questions about the legality and transparency of his work. Metallopov's group, on the other hand, is working to correct a mutation in a gene called MYBPC3, which causes hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, or HCM. This thickening of heart muscle causes a wide variety of heart problems. HCM most often makes news when it unexpectedly claims the life of a young athlete, and autopsies reveal a previously undiagnosed heart condition. There is no cure. Some of his most extreme critics have called for a moratorium on similar work, but Metallopov hopes the backlash doesn't interfere with his team's research. Moratorium, says Metallopov. I hate that word. A stall in the group's work would mean turning away from an issue Metallopov has felt strongly about for years. As a graduate student in clinical genetics, he recalls learning how to diagnose inherited diseases based on a patient's genes, and he was unsatisfied with the end game. You tell the parents, hey, we found it. This is a mutation causing this disease, he says, and then the patient is going to say, now what? But that's it. Our work is done. It then became clear to him that one way to tackle these diseases, like cystic fibrosis, sickle cell anemia, and Huntington's, would be to fix the genetic mutations early in life, before any damage to the gene is done, really early, in the embryo. But only recently has there been a clear way to do it. The earliest work on what would become CRISPR, short for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats, happened some 30 years ago, but it took researchers nearly all that time to figure out the full CRISPR-Cas9 system and to begin harnessing it for gene editing. The system of DNA sequences occurs naturally in bacteria, helping them fight off attacking viruses. Bacteria incorporate a small chunk of DNA when they encounter a specific virus, a little souvenir to remember their viral attacker in the future. The bacteria's defense system includes a seek-and-destroy function that uses the viral DNA as a search image. Part of the mechanism includes production of the protein Cas9, which snips the DNA that matches the template. For a virus trying to infiltrate a bacterial cell, this means game over. Today, biologists have learned to reprogram CRISPR-Cas9 to cut any type of DNA in a cell, not just viral, in a location of their choosing by giving it a new target to seek out. They've also discovered that after the DNA is cut by Cas9, cells will try to repair the break in the DNA. That repair system can then be manipulated into using a template provided by scientists, effectively cutting out one gene and replacing it with another. Metallopov and like-minded colleagues believe the promise of CRISPR is that they will be able to use it to replace a defective gene with a functioning one. To test this, the OSU team's experiments, published in the journal Nature, were straightforward. Using sperm from a man carrying the defective MYBPC3 gene and eggs from a healthy woman, they would see if they could use CRISPR-Cas9 to repair the disease-causing gene. They injected each egg with a sperm carrying the mutation and a CRISPR-Cas9 package. In this case, the package included the DNA search image that would help Cas9 find the defective gene. They also included a sequence of DNA that matched the normal version of the gene, which the cell uses as a repair template to mend the cut in its DNA. They added a little calling card to this repair template, swapping out two nucleotide bases that would change the sequence, but not the function of the normal gene. With this, they would know whether the cell used their template. Their experiments worked, but not in the way they expected. Cas9 did locate and cut the disease-causing gene the embryo had inherited from its father. But instead of using the template the researchers provided, the embryo used the normal gene from the mother as a template, resulting in two normal genes. However, some scientists remain skeptical the experiments worked as well as Metallopov's group claimed, because of the difficulties of confirming that the gene editing went as planned. Their biggest holdup? It's possible that instead of two normal genes, the embryos actually could have one normal gene and one missing gene, caused by what's called a large deletion. This phenomenon has been documented in a handful of other CRISPR cases and could explain why the researchers didn't detect any disease-causing genes when they examined the edited embryos. If critics are right, these embryos would be far from healthy. Paul Thomas, leader of the Genome Editing Laboratory and director of the South Australia Genome Editing Facility at the University of Adelaide and South Australian Health and Medical Research Institute, sought to directly answer the large deletion question. His team tested Metallopov's methods in mouse embryos and found these suspected large deletions were common. In response, Metallopov's group did a follow-up experiment to show that their embryos didn't have the deletions. But the critics, including Dieter Egli, a cell biologist at Columbia University, weren't terribly satisfied. Conclusive evidence for the proposed repair mechanism is still missing, he says. Thomas had a similar reaction. The reason for this difference between the two studies remains unclear, he says. It will be interesting to see if the results from Metallopov's group are replicated in studies using human embryos from independent laboratories. Science aside, human embryo research is a logistically tricky business. The work is not eligible for financial support by the National Institutes of Health, the main source of biomedical research funding in the U.S. The OSU team has worked around this with private funding, but it will face a big obstacle when it's ready to take the gene repair treatment, that's how they refer to their disease-removing embryo edits, to clinical trial. To do that, the team needs FDA approval. In 2015, however, Congress removed the FDA's funding to review research in which a human embryo is intentionally created or modified to include a heritable genetic modification. This doesn't stop Metallopov from moving his work forward. It just doesn't allow him to seek official approval in the U.S. So Metallopov says that when embryonic gene repair is ready for clinical trials, he'll take it to a country that allows it, but also has strong legal and ethical oversight, such as the U.K. He believes it's actually irresponsible not to continue to study and test the embryo repair techniques coming out of the lab. That's because once research is completed, the ideas are out there, with instructions in each study's method section. He worries researchers or clinicians in other countries with different regulations would run with them before they've been properly vetted. Of course we will do clinical trials overseas in a responsible way with proper oversight, says Metallopov. We have no choice. We have to do it. We already started, and we cannot leave it to in vitro fertilization clinics to do this job. When parents want to avoid passing their genetic condition to their children, Amato says, a viable option is to undergo in vitro fertilization, or IVF, using what's called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD. During PGD, doctors examine each embryo created in vitro and discard the ones that carry the disease. If gene repair can replace PGD, the process wouldn't have to happen, which could shorten successful IVF treatments. Although human embryos are created and subsequently discarded in this research process, the team hopes that in the long run, fewer embryos will be destroyed. Metallopov thinks that we won't see a legitimate gene-repaired human baby for up to a decade, although He Jiankui already demonstrated that someone might move forward with the technique, with or without scientific vetting and adequate oversight. Is this a slippery slope into designer babies? Not really, says Amato. Right now, she says, scientists don't even know the complex genetic underpinnings behind desirable traits, such as intelligence or athletic ability. It's not technically feasible, she says, but some would say that's a cop-out. Maybe one day we will know those genes. I think designer babies are way far off, says Amato, but not so distant that researchers shouldn't be thinking about taking steps now to regulate the technology that could create them. I definitely think it's something we should be thinking about and aware of. And now a history lesson, the grim origins of gluten-free. It took an act of war for doctors to learn how to treat celiac disease. The term gluten-free seems to be everywhere these days. Food labels, restaurant menus, cookbooks, even water bottles. While it's become trendy to avoid gluten, a protein found in popular foodstuffs like bread and pasta, humans have safely and enthusiastically consumed it for thousands of years. Food containing gluten remains a staple of the human diet around the world, providing sustenance to billions. So, why this apparent backlash against gluten? While the protein is a vital part of the human diet, for some people, it really is unsafe. The path to this seemingly simple discovery was long and torturous, dating back to a particularly bleak period of World War II. Holland was suffering in the winter of 1944 to 1945. The country was under siege, and the Nazis had cut off vital supplies. Starvation was rampant. The combination of extreme cold and famine came to be known as the Hunger Winter, Dutch for Hunger Winter. It was an act of war, Nazi retaliation after a railroad strike by Dutch workers, says Anne van Aragon, co-editor of The Hunger Winter, The Dutch in Wartime, Survivors Remember. Grocery stores were empty, and soup kitchens served only a thin, watery soup. Those who still had some physical strength traveled 100 miles or more to rural areas, mostly on foot, to beg or barter for food. Yet out of this horror came a medical breakthrough, one that still reverberates around the world today and helps millions of people every year, the treatment for celiac disease. Celiac disease, also known as celiac sprue, or sometimes simply sprue, is a chronic autoimmune disease that affects the small intestine, the main organ that absorbs food into the body. People with classic celiac disease can't digest the gluten found in wheat and other grains. Untreated, this intolerance can interfere with overall digestion, leading to severe diarrhea, malnutrition, weight loss, and eventually, death. People with celiac disease can literally starve to death in the presence of food. Their reaction to gluten blocks absorption of what nutrients they can safely consume. Celiac disease, which is hereditary and can develop any time after a person starts eating gluten-containing foods, has been around for thousands of years. The Greek physician Aretaeus of Cappadocia wrote the first account of the disease around the 1st century AD. He described patients whose food passed through them without being digested, calling the disease the celiac diathesis, stemming from the Greek word coelia, meaning abdomen. For centuries afterwards, the diagnosis served as a death sentence, as no one knew the cause or any treatment. Physicians did recognize that some patients improved and could even gain weight when consuming highly modified diets. Experimental nutritional regimens based on eating mainly rice, mussels, or bananas achieved varying degrees of success. Still, these diets were unappetizing at best, and most people couldn't maintain them over time. It would take the wartime famine to provide the final clue for how doctors could help patients with celiac disease. Dutch pediatrician William Karel Dick had a long-standing interest in celiac disease, and in the 1930s he encountered patients who told him their symptoms worsened after eating bread or biscuits. He suspected something related to bread was the cause of the disease. Then when the hunger winter came in 1944, Dick saw its effects firsthand. People in the western Netherlands had to subsist on just 500 to 1,000 calories each day, sometimes even less. The famine was severe. More than 4 million people went hungry, and between 20,000 to 30,000 people died. No bread was to be had in the cities, with the rare exception of black marketeers and offering a barely edible product of extortionate prices, says Van Aragon. It wasn't a wheat shortage so much as an absence of wheat. But at the same time, Dick realized, children with celiac disease were seeing improvement in their symptoms. Some even gained weight. It made him curious. After the famine ended along with the war in May 1945, food supplies from the Allies, including wheat and bread, flooded back into the Netherlands. That's when Dick made a critical observation. Celiac patients had a clear and rapid relapse. The connection was enough to get Dick to rigorously investigate the relationship between diet and celiac symptoms. Over the next roughly 5 years, and through experiments with wheat-free diets, Dick determined that avoiding foods with wheat and related grains reduced diarrhea and allowed for weight gain in people with celiac disease. They usually felt better, too. Scientists working together determined that gliadin, a protein fraction of wheat, rye, and barley gluten, was the trigger of bowel inflammation in celiac disease, says Carol Semrad, a physician and celiac disease expert at the University of Chicago School of Medicine. These findings led to the modern treatment of celiac disease, a gluten-free diet. On a strict gluten-free diet, most individuals with celiac disease have complete bowel recovery. Over 70 years later, Dick's discovery remains the cornerstone of celiac disease treatment. But questions about the treatment linger. Although the gluten-free diet is highly effective, says Semrad, gluten is present in most foods in a Western diet. Breads, pastas, pizza, desserts, processed foods, making it difficult to follow. It's also hard for food manufacturers to maintain completely gluten-free conditions, even residual amounts of gluten used in the production of normal foods can contaminate gluten-free foods. That's why research into novel treatments for celiac is underway. New therapies under study include oral enzymes to fully digest gluten in the diet, and a vaccine to promote tolerance to gluten, says Semrad. If successful, people with celiac disease finally may be able to eat what everyone else gets to enjoy. On the other hand, many of those without the disease choose to eat gluten-free foods, or even try to adhere to a gluten-free diet. It's unclear how helpful this is to people without celiac disease. As long as a balanced diet is maintained, though, going gluten-free won't cause any harm, and some people do feel better. These folks may have non-celiac gluten sensitivity, and researchers are working to learn more about this condition, including whether gluten is the true cause. Celiac disease has gone from being a lethal enigma to a bona fide medical success story. Since World War II, we have learned a tremendous amount about it, based on decades of research by thousands of individuals. But we owe a special debt to a curious Dutch pediatrician who kept his eyes open and made good clinical observations, even under the worst conditions. And now a short selection from their feature celebrating 100 years of relativity. It's all relative. Einstein's theory of gravity may be complicated, but it's our best way of understanding the universe. An astronaut wakes up in a spaceship with no memory of how she got there. Sitting alone in a chair, she wonders, where in the universe am I? The ship has no windows. Its instruments are dead. The only clue is the push of the chair against her body. Phew, there's gravity, she thinks. Her vessel must still be on Earth. But then a second possibility occurs to her. The ship could be accelerating through space, pressing her into the seat like a race car picking up speed. From inside the vessel, there is terrifyingly no way to tell. This spacefarer's dilemma would have been familiar to Albert Einstein. His 1915 general theory of relativity built on the notion that gravity and acceleration are not just easily confused, but are one and the same. This equivalence, the happiest thought of Einstein's life, was his starting point for redefining gravity. According to relativity, anything that can happen inside of a box picking up speed, i.e. accelerating, also happens in the presence of gravity. Imagine, for example, a horizontal laser inside of an elevator that is accelerating upward. As the light travels sideways, the elevator rises, causing the beam to strike a spot on the wall slightly lower than where it started. If the elevator accelerates quickly enough, the beam visibly bends towards the floor. Einstein showed the same thing happens to a beam inside of a stationary elevator within a powerful gravitational field. The gravity bends the light. Similarly, he expected a beam of light of starlight should bend when passing through the sun's gravity. This prediction proved correct when the stars moved during the 1919 solar eclipse. To link acceleration and gravity in this way, Einstein overthrew one of his own heroes, Isaac Newton. You may have learned that Newton described gravity as a force, an invisible rubber band that pulls together objects with mass. Newton's math did a good job at predicting how everything from projectiles to planets moved. But it kept gravity separate from acceleration. Einstein argued that gravity isn't a force at all. He described it as a curvature of time and space caused by mass and energy. Confused? The German physicist was too, and he struggled with the theory for nearly a decade. He got help from mathematician Marcel Grossmann, an old friend who shared his notes when a young Einstein skipped class. Their math, laid down in 10 equations, explained how gravity could move around objects via a warped reality, accelerating without ever feeling any mysterious Newtonian forces. Einstein's peculiar predictions. Relativity makes numerous bizarre predictions, many of them experimentally verified. They only seem bizarre because we don't notice them in our daily lives. We live, for the most part, in Newton's reality. But beyond that lies Einstein's universe, where gravity bends space and time to its will. Here are some of the theory's strangest side effects. Gravity literally slows down time. Waves of light emitted by stars stretch out because of this time bending, and objects closer to a massive object age more slowly. super precise clocks, which tick according to the vibrations of atoms, have verified that gravity alters time's flow. Satellites have shown that rotating celestial bodies twirl the fabric of the cosmos around themselves, like honey twisted by a spoon, affecting the notion of gyroscope, the motion of gyroscopes. One prediction solved a long-standing dilemma, a weird wobble in Mercury's orbit that Newton's math couldn't account for. Astronomers had initially blamed a hidden planet called Vulcan. Relativity explained the wonky orbit in terms of the warping of space by the sun's powerful gravity. Tiny ripples in reality, caused by colliding black holes, have tripped sensors and highly sensitive instruments buried underground on Earth. The relative basics. The main takeaways behind Einstein's general theory of relativity. Number one, time and space are neither flat nor fixed. They are curved and distorted by mass and energy. Two, gravity is not a force, but rather a distortion of time and space. Three, the effects of gravity are indistinguishable from the effects of acceleration over a small space. Future flooding of our past. We already know flooding during extreme weather events, made worse by rising sea levels, threatens coastal communities and ecosystems globally. Now a team of European researchers has brought another target to our attention, the UNESCO World Heritage Sites that dot the Mediterranean coast. In a recent paper published in Nature Communications, the team estimated how likely these sites, including the ancient Greek city of Ephesus and the Baha'i holy places in Israel, will be submerged in the future. Using sea level rise predictions and flooding statistics from the Mediterranean Coastal Database, they calculated what that risk looks like today and what it might be in 2100. The team found that 37 of the 49 Mediterranean sites are already in danger of experiencing a flood event. This risk will increase to 40 sites by 2100. But these events don't threaten all sites equally. When determining risk, researchers considered how much of the site might flood, plus the likely depth of water. Enclosed is a map showing the current and future flood risk for each site, from blue to no risk, to yellow, moderate, to red, very high. And some of these dots include green dots around Naples, yellow dots around Dubrovnik. That's 4.1 to 7.0 risk. And other sites, including Venice, Tel Aviv, Rhodes, and Corfu. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodkey, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. Again, that's area code 919-832-5138. 5138.